Hello, 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 my lovelies. Welcome to The Witching Hour, also known as the coziest horror podcast on the internet. Trust me. Just trust me. Feel free to take a second and get comfortable. Maybe, you know, grab that basket of laundry you've been meaning to fold. Pick up that crochet project. Whatever floats your boat, you know, if you're on the train to or from work, I hope you have a smooth journey. And without further ado, let's get into the subject of today's episode. My relationship with Ryan Murphy's American Horror Story is complicated, to say the least. On the one hand, this anthology series will always have a special place in my heart. I mean, it was the bridge between my elementary school days of reading scary stories to tell in the dark and my high school, I just learned what film theory is and I'm going to be insufferable about it phase. On the other hand, when you look at the show's trajectory, it's pretty impossible to deny the dip in quality and general hype. But how did this happen? How does a show that for a while there was consistently good become something that is ultimately, aside from a few splash-in-the-pan moments of relevance, completely forgettable? I believe the problem lies with Ryan Murphy and the storytelling frameworks that he chooses to use. And I'll elaborate. Don't you worry about that. One thing I can do is elaborate. Ryan Murphy began his television career with the 1999 teen comedy parody series, Popular. While the series was not as impactful as Glee, Murphy's later foray into teen media satire, it is an early indication of the style of storytelling that would go on to define his career. Popular is an example of postmodern storytelling, where the story's framework is actually a part of the story itself. Alongside the main plot of the show, there is another, additional layer of storytelling that uses all the cliches and tropes of a teen drama to critique the genre and what it represents about our society. The humor of Popular wouldn't make sense to TV audiences of the 1950s because the genre that it makes fun of didn't exist yet. Murphy would go on to incorporate the postmodern storytelling framework in his most notable works like Glee, Nip Tuck, and the subject of today's episode, American Horror Story. Before we go any further, I want to spend just a little more time explaining what postmodern storytelling is, because I will be referencing this term a lot throughout this episode, and I don't like to throw jargon at my audience and hope it sticks. So, here to explain this concept is today's guest lecturer, cultural critic Tim Riley.
Can you give your official Tim Riley definition of postmodernism, since that's kind of the framework that I'm using?
To me, postmodernism means a hyper self-conscious approach to storytelling. So it is often storytelling that is nested inside another story. So it is a layered story. And if you can think of it as the storyteller introducing themselves as part of the subject of the story, or at least the frame as part of the story. So the story is busy pointing out at different points along the story, oh, remember, this is a story. This is a fiction. Remember, don't take this is not really happening. This is a fiction, right? So it's actually pointing out sort of the process and the mode of storytelling. And the best kind of postmodernism is actually commenting on the frame as it goes by. So postmodernism turns the story itself into one of its subject. We have seen the postmodern impulse throughout art history, where Shakespeare has examples of stories within stories, plays within plays. Hamlet's play within a play is a very ingenious use of this postmodern impulse. Andy Warhol emerges in the 60s as a pop artist, and he begins to critique modernism through commercial design. And this is a fairly radical notion at the time. We take it for granted now because it's all around us and it happens. Everything has quotes around it. But Warhol appropriation of a Brillo soap ad and a Brillo soap box as a piece of art is a pretty substantial leap in art terms, and saying we are surrounded by art and culture and commercial design everywhere we go. And why don't we think of this as art? Why do we just dismiss it as, oh, that's just commercial design? And that new angle on how we perceive art and where art can exist That's very Warholian, and that leads directly into the postmodern impulse, because once you start doing that, then you are kind of saying, oh, isn't this clever? Like, an album cover can be art. That is not a modernist idea. But what we have is modernism kind of crashing into commercialism. And then how do we make sense of that? And what are the storytelling implications of that? So I was talking about the Abbott Elementary mockumentary format, right? The idea that that is a mainstream storytelling mode, the general audience, the TV audience, the mainstream audience understands that the mockumentary is not really a documentary. That's a fiction. And this is, it's not only not a real elementary school and these are fictional characters, but these are fictional characters who are addressing a fictional filmmaker, right? And nobody really thinks, oh, do we get to see the final documentary? Like, that's not the question. The thing is, it's just pure storytelling technique. It's like these people get to share their inner thoughts about the meeting they just had or the lunchroom incident that just occurred. They share it directly with the camera. That becomes a new storytelling mode. The idea that this has become so popular and widespread now is really interesting. If you had shown Abbott Elementary to an audience in the 50s, it would have been very confusing for them.
So in your, obviously opinions are subjective, but in your opinion, what makes a piece of media a strong use of the postmodern storytelling framework?
It's important to consider postmodernism as a mode, and the mode of storytelling or the format or the medium or the platform, the mode is neutral. So you can have good postmodernism and weak postmodernism. And doing something in the postmodern mode does not immediately make it good. To judge good postmodernism from bad postmodernism, I'm tempted to think of two different layers. So one layer is it an effective use of postmodernism? Is it clear that we're having storytelling on at least two different layers? And that is actually a very delicate maneuver, right? It's not easy to pull off. You have to really engage the audience on a couple different levels at the same time. And then the second level is, are you trying to make a statement about storytelling, or are you trying to make a statement about something else and storytelling is secondary, or it's part of what you're saying, but it's not the totality of what you're saying? BoJack Horseman is a great example. It's a critique of cartoons, and it's also a really great cartoon narrative in itself. It's a critique of Hollywood culture, a critique of celebrity culture, and at the same time, it's a very savvy piece of storytelling that is about more than storytelling. It's about a lot of things. It's about childhood trauma. It's about addiction. It's about relationships. It's about identity, the formation of an identity. Postmodernism can be about a number of different things, including storytelling. At its root, I think postmodernism really is an examination of the storytelling instinct, right? Why are we so addicted to stories? Why do we seek out stories every day? Every day we're all hunting down our favorite stories, to the extent that it's like it can be really a cultural addiction.
The postmodern framework is very prevalent in modern horror media. There are several like hyper self-aware horror movies that kind of poke fun at the genre that they're inhabiting. If that makes sense. I think of movies like Scream, A Cabin in the Woods, and most recently Late Night with the Devil as examples of overt usage of the postmodern storytelling framework. All of these movies are framed within an additional layer of quotes where we, the audience, are constantly reminded that we are watching a movie, and we're meant to actually engage with the questions and critiques that the story poses. You know, why does sex always lead to death in a slasher movie? Why does the plot of every 21st century horror movie feel like it's thrown together in a lab? And why are all late night talk show hosts so blatantly evil? I'm kidding. Anyways, instead of trying to convince us that this movie is a fiction, we're actually encouraged to see it as one. We're supposed to not just consider the message of the plot and the meaning of the plot, but the storytelling method used to present it. Okay, so what does all of this have to do with American Horror Story? Well, American Horror Story is full of these postmodern quotation stories. See Lena Dunham as Valerie Solanas in Cult, but listen, I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm jumping the Lena Dunham shark. Each season kind of employs the framework of an actual American horror story from history, such as the Columbine shooting, the Night Stalker killings, the 2016 election, etc., etc. This is done to varying degrees of success. When it does it right, I feel like a good season of American Horror Story is kind of like a funhouse mirror for whatever social norm or cultural moment it is seeking to criticize. But when the show is off its game, the postmodern framework honestly just feels more like a gimmick to create buzz by connecting the show to relevant events rather than a thoughtfully used narrative device that actually adds something to the plot and, you know, has something to say. So let's use two seasons of American Horror Story to try and examine this a little bit further. The first season of American Horror Story debuted in 2011 to mixed reviews. The series follows the misfortunes of the Harmon family as they move from Boston to a suburb outside of LA into a beautiful house, their dream house, actually, and it just so happens that that house is full of murder. Like, decades-long history of all manner of, like, death and gore, and I'm not gonna get into it. Watch the show. If you haven't seen it, you'll see what I mean. And unfortunately, the dead here are not sleeping peacefully, and okay, so the way the ghosts work is a little unclear, I'm not gonna lie, but basically, if you die in the house, you are forever bound to it. Sorry, spoiler. A lot of the horror here is rooted in the fears and the prejudices of 2000s suburban America, specifically this fear of a deviant other, some sort of like corruption that's festering inside your nice post-war three-story home that seeks to destroy the world. And I think this is why much of the story revolves around a fictionalized version of the Columbine shootings with Tate Langdon as the perpetrator and Constance Langdon as this like series fictionalized version of Sue Klebold. A central theme of Murder House is really just examining what it means to be the other and how otherness interacts with quote unquote normal society. Sorry, not to get normal people scare me on y'all. I don't want to say normative society because that feels way too academic. So I'm just saying normal, but just sorry. Moving on. Specifically, what are the traits in people that are signaled out as being indicators of otherness or deviance? And what does that kind of say about what we as a society deem as bad? For example, Tate Langdon is so clearly evil, and yet Constance never subjects him to the same treatment as his siblings because in her eyes, he is her only perfect child. The Harmons are willing to stay in the murder house despite its gruesome history because it is the perfect house, and this is ultimately why they meet their unfortunate fate. Murphy's critique of the superficiality of suburbia and all of the horror that lurks beneath it raises questions about what we deem as normal and how we look to these cultural examples of deviance, things like mass shootings or brutal murders, to distract ourselves from actually examining our feelings and how we may be contributing to this deviance. Ultimately, this season really shows how there is no other. There's no evil stranger lurking on the corner. This corruption is already here. It's inside our homes. It's inside us as well. Every character in this series is their own undoing, and that is the true horror. And all of this is supported by an interesting plot and a fleshed out setting that feels just as lively as the characters. The whole, like, layout of the murder house and all of the detail that went into it, I really love. I feel like this season kind of, like, cemented, okay, like, this is what the American Horror Story aesthetic is. The acting is also really good. Oh my god, I love Jessica Lange as Constance. She manages to be so campy, but at the same time, I find her storyline genuinely upsetting, because I can tell that she truly doesn't understand what she's doing wrong. Like, I also think that Thaisa Farmiga, Connie Britton, and Bill McDermott work pretty well together as the family. They're kind of like perfectly insufferable, almost. This season also kind of like broke Evan Peters out of the adorable, like, best friend category into more of like a main romantic lead status as Tate Langdon. And unfortunately, the cultural reaction to sexy school shooter was as bad as we expected. I would just like to take a quick minute to thank this week's sponsor, HelloFresh. Now, we talk about a lot of scary stuff in this podcast, but let me just say, as a college student living on my own, few things terrify me quite like trying to feed myself, which is why I'm so happy to be partnering with HelloFresh, because they take all of that anxiety and fear that comes with meal planning and the difficulties of searching for recipes and boil it all down to a simple delivery system. These meals, as well as the schedule for delivery, are super customizable. You can personalize it to whatever works best for you and your dietary and schedule needs. And let me just say from personal experience, I've found HelloFresh super helpful in making sure that I'm still getting nutritious, full meals without sacrificing a huge time commitment that I can't really give. So, for free breakfast for life, go to HelloFresh.com/freegarden. One free breakfast item per box while subscription is active. That is free breakfast for life just by going to HelloFresh.com/freegarden. Thank you so much. So I started off with the good, but unfortunately, we do have to provide both sides. Yes, I am a journalist, and we have to talk about a season of American Horror Story that I think is not so good. American Horror Story Cult is framed around the events of the 2016 presidential election. It came out in 2017. So many key details of the season. For example, Killer Clowns, the political influence social media has. It's very much like a time capsule almost of 2016 slash kind of like 2017 pop culture. I mean, like, one of the main villains for the first, like, at least like third of the plot is a bunch of killer clowns. Like, do y'all remember the Killer Clowns? It's that. And the season follows a liberal lesbian couple, Allie and Ivy, as their Midwestern hometown is overrun with killer clowns and their local government is taken over by local edgelord Kai Anderson and his weird, like, Trump MAGA culture-y cult. The season is, like, it's so successful at capturing the aesthetic of that time, but ultimately when I think of cult, I think of that Abby Lee Miller quote where she's like, "You were good, I'm waiting for you to be great." You know, I think this is probably one of the most, like, overt uses of the postmodern storytelling framework in American Horror Story, to the point that they have Evan Peters in a wig playing Andy Warhol at one point. I think that there's a difference between something being very overtly postmodern and it being, well, like, a coherent use of the storytelling framework that actually, like, uses it to its advantage. If that makes sense, I'm gonna get into it. Don't worry. Ultimately, I think that there is nothing really that original about this season's critique of mainstream pop culture. I think that that's part of what makes Cult so forgettable. Aside from all of the ridiculousness, like Evan Peters doing so much weird shit. Oh my god, they made that man do so much. If nothing else, we learned Evan Peters has range. The idea of all politicians are just cult leaders in disguise is interesting. It just doesn't receive enough attention in the story because we're getting so wrapped up in reminding people, oh, this is about the 2016 election. The way that they go about it just feels more of like a gimmick, clickbaity almost use of postmodernism. Honestly, at this point in the, like, American Horror Story historical canon, Hotel was interesting. But I think that, like, Roanoke really threw a lot of people, and the numbers were already going down between, like, Freakshow and Hotel. And I don't know. I think that this is all, like, entirely just me making assumptions. Like, don't, like, take this seriously. I am just a girl on the internet with a microphone. But I think that, like, there was a lot of pressure of, oh, shit, like, American Horror Story isn't as relevant anymore. Like, our core audience is all fucking watching Scream Queens. We need to kind of of like draw some people back in, we need to draw in like the newer like teen audience that's coming of age, and we need to like bring back in. I also do think that like some of it was genuine. I'm not saying this was all like completely disingenuous, but I think that it like marketing was definitely part of the decision to do this. One of the reasons that I say that is rather than like developing anything interesting to say with this framework, you're just showing me like stupid fucking like zeitgeist related shit, like Evan Peters smearing blended up Cheeto dust on his face. And it just feels like the sort of criticism that you'd find on like an episode of Jimmy Fallon. And I know Ryan Murphy is capable of being smarter than this. Ultimately, I feel like Cult was made to kind of comfort people like the main heroine, Allie, rather than like genuinely examining her flaws and motivations the way that he examines Kai, who is meant to represent this like victim of the alt-right pipeline turned like a neo-fascist neo-Nazi. I don't know. I think that depiction of the alt-right pipeline is done very well. It's one of the like few times where I was like, oh wow, this is like a great use of the postmodern framework, because at this point we had like just really been exposed to the Trump edgelord internet community, and I think we were all reeling a bit and trying to make sense of it. And I feel like Murphy's depiction does kind of like make sense of it and raise interesting questions. When it comes to Allie and what she's like meant to represent in this story, I just don't see the same attention to detail that we get from Kai. I genuinely like can't tell if Murphy is criticizing her actions or glamorizing them. Like, is that the message of Cults? That we should start buying pantsuits and ritually sacrificing our political opponents? Because listen, if that's the case, I'm literally so in. Bring me my green velvet cape and dagger. To give an example of a series that I think does the postmodern examination of MAGA culture well, The Boys is very strong in this. I know that showrunner Eric Kripke was still like developing the plot of season one during 2016, and I think you can really see the impact that the rise of MAGA culture had on the way the show's plot formed, because like in the original comic source material, none of the commentary on American politics or the perpetual adolescent state of American mainstream media was there. Like, the writers added all of that in, they just kept the storytelling frame of the comics, which was already very postmodern, and it added another layer of quotes around the story where now not only are the writers pointing out a flaw in American politics, they're also pointing out all of the flaws of the Marvel movie storytelling framework and industry that we as a society just cannot fucking break out of. And yeah, just like the writing is overall funnier and more insightful than Cult, and it just feels more like confident in what it has to say as a series. So I would be lying to y'all if I said that I dropped American Horror Story when the quality started to drop. I have unfortunately seen 11 out of 13 of the seasons, and yes, I will probably end up watching the next season that Ryan keeps hinting at whenever it comes out. It's infuriating because even when a season is subpar writing-wise, Ryan Murphy just somehow manages to poke the right motor neurons in my brain to keep me entertained. I know Cult is stupid, but I'm entertained by it. I find Lena Dunham as Valerie Solanas incredibly entertaining, and you could get me to watch at least 5 episodes off of cuntiness like that. I think this is where the problem lies when it comes to the slow and steady decline of American Horror Story. Yeah, you heard me. I'll admit it. It's me. I'm the problem. Me and all the other poor fools out there with Hulu subscriptions who will watch at least the first 3 episodes of whatever the next installment of AHS ends up being. I feel like every time, at least for the last 4 years, every time a new season of American Horror Story was teased, there would always be all of this excitement online of, oh, Ryan says we're going back to the glory days. We're going back to, like, the glory days of AHS, everybody. And then it just never really delivers. Like, I remember people being excited before Delicate came out because aesthetically, it looked like we might be going back to the glory days. And ultimately,
Delicate did nothing for me. Delicate was forgettable as fuck. You could not pay me to be entertained by that. I'm sorry. This series has become another one of Hollywood's dead horses that TV executives will keep beating with batons as long as we, the audience, will pay our streaming service subscription to watch. And because of this, Ryan Murphy no longer has to fight to convince audiences to care about American Horror Story. There's a built-in fan base already there who is willing to stream whatever bullshit he puts in front of us. Because of that, his focus seems to have shifted away from the content of the story, the quality of the story, having a coherent plot, maybe, having something like interesting to say about your subject matter. All of that has kind of been tossed to the wayside in favor of capturing the aesthetics of the story's frame. In the end, I'm still interested to see what American Horror Story has to offer. I think that when a series uses American society as the basis for its framework, you basically have like an infinite wealth of plot lines and inspiration, because American society is fucked and very stupid, and it's going to continue being that way until we all die. So I don't think AHS's potential has completely dried up, but I think Ryan Murphy either needs to devote 100% of his attention to this next season, or he needs to step down from the showrunner position and let somebody else take the reins. Anyways, thank you so much for listening. I have been Lucy, your host. If you folded some laundry while you listened to this, I'm proud of you. Maybe you completed a little art project. Maybe you did some homework. If you made yourself a nice dinner, I hope it's very yummy, and I hope you don't have too many plates to clean. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye.